Warren Carter, pros and cons. What'd you think about it? Reflect. Yeah.
Where it talks about Jesus exercising
the demoniac.
And he made that tie. His name was Legion. He said, "I am Legion of many." And he made that tie to the Roman Empire being demonic.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. Like that one. I will say this. There's a couple of things I will say about that interpretation of Mark chapter 5. Number one, I will say, I too felt like, wow, that's stretching it a bit. He also has that in Matthew Empire where he makes the same argument. However, I will say this.
Is that what he's saying?
What?
Because the name is Legion, they have Roman
Empire. He would say that the empire itself would be demonically driven. Which is not totally bad theology, it's just a stretch in that from that text. Because I don't think that you can make the theological leap because the name Legion is that therefore Rome is demonic. However, I would say it is interesting that he uses the name Legion. I mean, hello? Is there more of an imperial term than this? This is one of the key elements of the Roman army that perpetuates their dominance. And where are they? In the Decapolis, a highly Hellenized region. Therefore, whenever he says, "My name is Legion," all of a sudden, not only is it describing just a moniker, it's describing, well, we even say, as a result of that, we say, you know, there would have been anywhere from 2,000 to 6,000 of these demons inside of him because that's the name Legion. That's how much a Legion is. But Legion's a very specific term for military. It's a very specific military term. It's not just kind of like he says, you know, "My name is Empire." I mean, he doesn't say that. He says, "Legion." This is, I am enlisted in a kingdom that is fighting to advance what we're supposed to be doing. And part of the evidence of that is I've taken over this guy. And he would even possibly say, by extension, the region. Now, let me develop this a bit further. It is true that we do find in Matthew's gospel, whenever it says there are 2,000 pigs that end up getting killed. And if a legion can be anywhere from 2,000 to 6,000, that's another interesting imperial connection. Also, the 10th for Tensus is the name of the Roman legion that would have been in the region of Syria at the time. And there, on their Roman standard, on their thing that represented their legion, their particular group, which I have a picture of it, not with me, but I have a picture of it, there's a pig. Those imperial connections, to me, all of a sudden start to go, huh. And then you start to ask the question, why did the people freak out and want Jesus to leave? I mean, what was it? They were just afraid of that type of power? Maybe. Or he could have destroyed their economy. But also, if all the pigs are slaughtered in a region of a legion that has as its particular symbol a pig, you may be sitting there going, "Oh my goodness, you know what, just get out of here. I don't know what you are, I don't know who you are, you're clearly powerful, but if you start doing stuff like that and they misinterpret it, the fury's coming down on us. Get out of here. I need you out of here. We don't know what to do with you. Frankly, we don't care what to do with you. We just don't want the wrath of the Legion to come down on us." So to suggest that there's no imperial underlying in this text, I think is to overlook some of the key elements that are surfacing. To suggest that I can make a theological statement about the Roman Empire based on this text, I think is a bit of a jump, but it's not as far a jump as maybe we'd want to think it is. You follow me? I'm not totally comfortable, especially because, I'll be honest with you, one of the things I'm most uncomfortable with Warren Carter is his exegesis at times. Nevertheless, the lens with which he brings, I think it's something, it should give you pause. It should make you think, huh. That would explain why the people kicked him out of the region pretty quickly. I mean, it would, especially in the Decapolis, whenever you're away from the center of the empire, you go overboard to try to make sure you show that you are really a part of that empire. And they're on the edges. They're right next to Parthia. They're on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. They're next to the enemy. You're going to make sure that you very clearly are on the side of Rome if you're that close to Parthia. So, am I totally sold in this interpretation? No. However, he doesn't even present it very well in that book. He presents it better in Matthew Empire, and it's even not that well presented there. However, I think that there are elements you can pull together to say, you can make a strong argument that there's something political happening there. Does that make sense? You follow me? I'm not totally sold on everything Carter writes. Nevertheless, I like the lens he's bringing to the table, which is predominantly the lens that we're looking at. Anyway, good. No, I'm glad we're interacting with stuff that you're not totally sure about. Yeah?
Quick question. Where is it that we find the 10 standards, the 10th legion standard?
What do you mean?
Like, is that in the primary source?
Yeah, I've got a picture of it. I mean, either through archaeological evidence, through text. I mean, the legions, especially because they would shift at times. We'd have legions that would get wiped out, or they would add some. And every time they had a deity attached to them, as well as a particular symbol. Every time. And so it's not hard to drum up what... Don't get me wrong, there are some legions that we just don't know. But the majority of them we do. Because it says a lot about who they are. And why would the pig be important to them? Think something we've already talked about. Roman mythology. Who was Numitor? Yeah, well, Faustulus was the pig herder for Numitor. And he actually, Faustulus would have been the adopted father of Remus and Romulus, who themselves were swine herdsmen for a time period. Therefore, pigs were not unclean. It is actually attached to their myth of the founding and somewhat honorable to have that pig as your Roman legion symbol. It ties you back to Remus and Romulus. It's not a bad lineage. Other stuff. Yeah, Jeremy.
Those parts that kind of maybe wonder if Warren Carter's a preterist.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was talking about the New Jerusalem and how they were already coexisting with the empire and stuff. And were already living in the New Jerusalem.
He wasn't coming. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know much about his eschatology, to be honest with you. Yeah, and he may be. I will say that the driving a lot of modern scholarship that's coming out, primarily from the UK, would date Revelation pre-70. Matter of fact, the majority of it, in my PhD defense. Even one of the guys there that wasn't a Revelation scholar just assumed it was written pre-70, and we had to have a 15-minute conversation right in the middle of the defense just about the date of Revelation. And I was thankful I had just got done writing 40 pages on it, because I don't think I would have had it very clearly in my head of why I thought it was 96. But, yeah, I mean, it's pretty much starting to become widely accepted in scholarship. Revelation was definitely pre-70, which is very strange, because scholarship usually does the opposite. Oh, that's 2nd century, even though tradition says it's the middle. Tradition says it's 95, 96, 94, 96. And they're like, no, it's 70. Pre-70. Whoa. When do we ever go backwards? Revelation. Revelation's always backwards. Anyway. Other stuff. I really don't know that much about his eschatology. Sorry. Yep.
I have 1 Peter, and he says in there, honor the emperor. Mm-hmm. Stuff that Carter talked about, honoring the emperor, I thought he kind of push the line and stuff, talking about how offer up sacrifices and pray for but not to, and the whole idol worship thing that he talked about, like it's okay to do it as long as you're not doing it wholeheartedly. It just seems,
well, he was affirming those actions.
Yeah.
I don't remember. I mean, he was saying that Peter was affirming that.
Yeah, well, yeah, in the book. Yeah.
What is your reaction to that?
Well, I put in my paper that Jesus doesn't say that it's okay, you know, as long as you're not doing it wholeheartedly. He's saying, you know, don't do it. And if you don't, I mean, you're going to get persecuted for it, and you'll probably die for it. But hey, stick to what I'm saying. And I don't think Peter or Paul or anybody else would say anything different.
Yeah. No, I mean, I would agree with that. Matter of fact, I mean, where he's getting at is Jewish relationships with Rome. The Jews did have a deal struck with Rome until AD 70, until the revolution, that they did not have to offer sacrifices to the emperor, but they could offer sacrifices for the emperor in the temple. They didn't pray to the emperor, but they prayed for the emperor, and they were okay with that. Roman Empire was, and the Jews were too. Regarding idols and stuff like that, no, Jews had an allergic reaction to anything remotely like that. And Pontius Pilate's interaction with the Jews displays that clearly. Whenever he brings a graven image into the city, and the Jews go and they start, they don't revolt, but they want to, and he surrounds them and basically says, "We will kill you if you don't allow this image to be put up in the temple." And they, all 150 of them, they lay down with their necks exposed and they say, "Do what you must." And that nonviolent protest actually leads to Pontius Pilate retreating and saying, "Whoa, clearly this isn't the right tactic." So he's not pulling that out of thin air. Nevertheless, yeah, it would be hard for me to rectify some of the other statements about, especially in Revelation, about worshiping idols and the way in which we interact with the empire, as opposed to just half-heartedly doing it. I'm not sure I could get on that bandwagon either. So, but you understand where he's getting it. I'm not saying it's legitimate, because Jews and Christians continuously, that's one of the big things for Christians, is to redefine themselves as separate and different from the Jews while still claiming to the same theological heritage. But the interaction with the empire, you'd have to give me some more evidence on that than just your, not you, but him, pontifications about what you think Peter might be saying based on the way in which the Jews were interacting with them. But at the time Peter would have been writing that, if you believe in kind of an earlier dating, it would have been whenever the Jews actually did have that agreement with Rome still in vogue, in place. So, other stuff.
This is just kind of going back to the thing we talked about with the Legion and his stretching the text beyond what it can do. But in the first or second chapter, he talks a lot about Pilate's interaction with the Jews for Jesus' trial. Psychoanalyzes Pilate based on the text that we have. And, it just seemed like it was a stretch, saying, Pilate says this to get a Jewish reaction so that he can later do this. And it's just...
Yeah, the stuff I had the most problem with in that book was the Pilate stuff. Where I was just like, bro, how do you shove that in there? I didn't know how he was, and again, like he even said, psychoanalyzing. I'm going, man, I don't know if Pilate was really just wanting to kill Jesus and just trying to instigate the Jews to actually do it for him. I mean, and the whole washing the hands of it, I'm going, no, I think Pilate was genuinely trying to figure out the political situation where he was going to be able to progress the best. And killing any sort of rebellious or somebody a part of a revolution is not necessarily a positive political move. I think he overextends the evidence that we have for Pilate. Not just in this book. Apparently, Helen Bond thinks he does in other books as well. But you can talk. You can ask her that question whenever. So, what do you think about Warren Carter? I think his stuff is rubbish. That's probably what you'll hear. Anyway. Other stuff. Yes, hi.
What did you think about when he said how the sword comes from Jesus' mouth in Revelation wasn't, him imitating violence the way Rome
was or was not?
It wasn't.
Okay.
But it was more of a, because it came from his mouth, it was more of a word of justice.
I mean, there was actually a paper at the British New Testament Conference on this very issue where they were basically trying to save Revelation from any of the violence it could have possibly have done, even from God himself. And I don't share that same sentiment. I don't know why I need to do that. The paper at the British New Testament Conference was arguing that every time fire is used in Revelation, it is never judgment, it is always purification. And that's just silly. And I mean, with all due respect to Simon Woodman, that's ridiculous. Because fire is not the only image of violence being done by God to people that are in judgment. Nevertheless, I will say this about Revelation. Never once, the most violent book in the entire New Testament, in my estimation, never once is any time a Christian ever a part of that, doing that violence. They're always having violence done to them. The only one that does violence in Revelation is either Jesus or God, every time. At that point, whenever you're saying the word from his mouth, I'm going to distinguish it from Rome's violence because it's where, I mean, like, really? Like another one, number one, I feel like there's semantic games being going on there. Number two, how do you separate the violence being done by people from the people that are speaking for the violence to be done? So because let's just say, you know, Gaddafi's not pulling a trigger, we're not going to hold him responsible for any of the violence that's occurring right now? Really? Like that's the hairs we're going to split? Come on, that's convenient from an ivory tower, but that's never the way it is. Did the emperor exempt from all the violence just because he wasn't the one that was using the swords killing people? No. He still has violence on his track record. Therefore, I am okay with Jesus doing violence with people at the day of judgment because he's the only one that should be able to exert violence because he's the only one that is just and he's the only one that is the one that has the perspective that can mete out violence at a discretion that is considered justified. So to make that distinction, I think it's silly. That's where I'm going. You can't find imperial connections under every rock. You can't ignore them when they're there. Like, I don't think you can ignore this. I think you've got to wrestle with this. The implications that he articulated may be something that is overstated. Nevertheless, you can't say there's no implications here. There is something politically threatening that is happening here. And I don't think I need to go as far as to say that what Jesus is trying to show or the Gospel of Mark is trying to show is that Rome is, in fact, demonic. Nevertheless, I don't think that you could also say that the Gospel of Mark doesn't say that Rome is totally fighting for the kingdom of God. To say the opposite's foolish. You see what I mean by that? So yeah, the whole sword in the mouth thing, well, let's be careful. That's a little bit extended. Nevertheless, there's political implications of the one who's actually meting out the judgment as opposed to the people that think they can down here. Yeah?
With that discussion of the violence and revelation, I did appreciate, though, how you talked about like the first four seals as far as like whatever happens there. I don't remember the exact things, but first, like they're not so much active judgment as it is just God letting what would happen because of Rome's behavior happen.
Absolutely.
So kind of, because it's, I mean, I have no problem with, you know, like you said, Jesus enacting violence or God's
right.
Revelation, but doesn't mean he has to for things.
No, and I should be more clear. I was talking about on the people of God,
right.
But yeah, there is violence that is consistently being done.
It's like, you know, it's not always just God doing his thing. Sometimes it's just allowing what Rome is doing wrong to.
Kind of. Actually, in Revelation chapter 6 with the four horsemen, God's not exempt from that movement because the four horsemen are called out by the words of the slain lamb. The slain lamb's the one that breaks the seal. Then a voice comes that says, come, and then the four horsemen come. Therefore, it's not that God is just a bystander of what's occurring. What it's saying is, and I do believe the four horsemen are pictures of Rome, because it even specifically says, number one, the first one's bent on conquest. Number two, the second one comes to take away peace, which is the very thing that Rome says they're coming to bring through their violence. And Revelation says, no, you're not bringing peace, you're taking it away, and that's how you went. And what's the result of that? Number three, economic destruction. That's the third horseman. Number four, death. So what it's saying is that this is what happens whenever Rome comes and brings what it is. And nevertheless, the fact that the Lamb is breaking the seal and the voice is coming says God's still the one that's in control of this, even when it is chaos and violence. And the Christians say, well, where are we in all of this? And that's the fifth seal. You're the ones getting killed, martyrs underneath the throne or underneath the altar that are crying out, when will you avenge our blood? And God says, when enough of you die. He says, you're not physically exempt from this. And then the very sixth seal is the ultimate judgment that comes, and it's called the great day of the wrath of the Lamb. So I do believe the first four are showing Rome, but I would in no way, because of Jesus' interaction, that say that God's an innocent bystander in what Rome's doing, and he's just kind of going, well, that's just kind of what happens. No, Revelation clearly says no matter what violence is occurring, he's always in control.
Well, I don't think that Carter would say that he wouldn't be in control of the situation, but from what I understand, maybe I'm just not presenting his ideas clearly, but I thought it was a different take on what was happening there.
Yeah, I think the four horsemen are definitely a description of Rome's political propaganda. Definitely a description of Rome's political program of advancing their kingdom through violence. I think that's what the four horsemen is mimicking. Which is ironic because later on that's the violence that's perpetuated by the dragon and the two beasts. And yet what I think Revelation 6 tells us is that even whenever they are the ones doing what they think they are doing and conquering, it's still under the hegemony of God. Yeah. Yeah, it's everywhere though. Yeah, Barry.
My question is, when do we use this kind of interpretation, when do we use imperial studies in our interpretation of the text? Because there is one point that we talk about, Matthew 24 and
uh-huh.
Matthew 24:28, where it talks about the eagle being brought about by the corpses of Rome.
Yeah.
And
And that's accurate.
The interpretation of the bird there is either eagle or vulture.
Yeah, actually, though, if you look up the word, because that's in Matthew 24, 29 or 30. The word is actually never used in the entire Bible for vulture ever, except for that verse. Never. It is always used to describe eagle. Every time. In Job, it's eagle. Every time. The why we translate that vulture, I have no idea. But the actual interpretation of that, it's not even corpse. It's body. It's whenever the eagle is circling or surrounding. Actually, it's surrounding. The word circling isn't even there. We've inserted that image into the translation of that text. Whenever the eagle is surrounding the body, that's when you know it's time to get out of Dodge. So the actual interpretation there of eagle, I think, clearly is pointing to Rome's participation in the destruction of the temple. And I think that the interpretation of vulture, I'll be honest with you, I don't understand why people in any way, shape, or form say that word can ever be translated vulture, because it never is, not even in antiquity. Even whenever you go outside of the Bible, that word's never used for vulture, ever. We have words for vulture, and it's not the word. It is the word we consistently translate eagle, except for that text. So whenever he brings up that point, I do believe that he is right. It is eagle.
How far does that go back? I mean, how far does it go back to them translating that vulture?
I don't know how they translate all those translations, but that'd be an interesting study just to figure out where this translation anomaly arose. That'd be a very interesting study. The etymology of an awkward translation. It's a legitimate study. But I do think it's theologically driven. Absolutely, it's theologically driven. I read somebody's book 2 years ago in this passage that was a linguist. And I thought, they're going to get it right. And they totally overlooked it. Totally overlooked it. But I toiled over that word. Because I was like, it must mean vulture. Every translation says this. But you cannot find that word being used as vulture anywhere. It's always eagle. Except for that passage. So I don't know what to do for the people on that passage. I mean, the vulture, I think, is completely unjustified. However, what they're trying to do... Well, let me say this. Let me go back and have a little bit of grace for them. They're trying to make sense of the metaphor. What's the deal with the circle surrounding or gathering together with the body? That doesn't make any sense. Well, maybe it's the concept of a bird that's circling, you know, the body, a dead body, a corpse. Okay, I can see where you get there. Problem is linguistically, you have no leg to stand on. You're just trying to make sense of a metaphor that maybe you don't understand because you're not looking through the right lens. See? And to answer your ultimate question, when do we bring this in? Textual intersection. It's whenever you look at a text and you don't just see the fact that he says the word legion. That's not enough for me to say there's something happening there. It's whenever he combines it with a number in a parallel passage. Whenever it's connected with the tenth for tenses. When it's connected with Decapolis. All of a sudden now I'm going, whoa. There's a lot of textual intersection that's happening here that I maybe should stop overlooking and start taking more seriously. That's always the way in which we determine when empire studies should drive something and when it doesn't. And I think that's Warren Carter's major pitfall. He doesn't pay attention to textual intersection enough. He's just trying to find any connection he can. Well, that's dangerous. Like, that's irresponsible, theologically and historically. Because you can make something out of nothing. Nevertheless, to overlook it, I think, is just as irresponsible. Yep.
I have my Bible reference to Luke 17, where it also connects the vultures together. I don't think they're part of the same.
No, Luke 21 would be the Olivet Discourse in Luke.
No, it's Luke 17.
Yeah, I know, but what I'm saying is that the parallel passage would be in a different context at that point in Luke 17.
How would you draw the imperial connection in Luke 17?
I think the better... I don't mean to say the better question. I think the question we would be is, should we draw imperial connections in Luke 17 in the same way that we've drawn them in Matthew? Because they may be using an image that maybe has multiple different derivations. Symbols don't have necessarily one point of reference. Ever. That's the whole point. is that symbols are so multi-layered that like an onion, you continue to peel it and there's just more to peel. Therefore, I would ask, how is Luke using it in Luke 17 in light of the fact that Matthew 24 seems to have it heavily political? Does the heavily political parallel passage in Matthew 24 impact Luke 17, or would it be trying to force a square peg into a round hole? And that's the question. Is there textual intersection? Just because there's parallel passage, sometimes they don't commentate on each other. Sometimes the parallel passage, especially in the synoptics, you'll have parallel metaphors that in one gospel means something very clear eschatologically, and you pull it over into the other gospel and it's just not saying the same thing. Totally different context. The Luke 17 I'm not as familiar with, to be honest with you, but I know it's not in the Olivet Discourse because that's Luke 21. So that'd be the Lucan people here. That may be a question you need to, whenever somebody does their presentation on Luke, ask that question to them. Okay, is that fair? Are you doing Luke? Okay, ask that question to them. Luke 17, you have an apparently a political passage. What do you do with that image? So people that do Luke, write it down. Yeah, Hannah.
Do you think it's ever possible, like especially for Carter, he like takes a lot of liberties with the political side of things, just like reading politics into every single sentence that is in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Is it ever possible that the New Testament writers say something that could be political, but they don't mean it politically?
Absolutely. And again, that comes to textual intersection. This is, I'll be honest with you, goes back to my critique of Empire Studies, of Warren Carter, who's one of the major voices of this. Just because there is an imperial connection between saying grace and peace to you, doesn't necessarily mean that their goal in saying that is to knock out the legs of the empire. The goal of the Christian writers at all time is to develop an alternative empire. And not in the sense of, this is using language that the New Testament uses. We are a different kingdom. We are not of this world. We are a holy nation, a royal priesthood. We are a completely different empire than the world has ever seen. And the goal of all the Christian documents is to construct, is to develop, encourage, to support, to admonish this empire. That's the goal. There will be byproducts in this act of subverting the other empire. Whether that's intentional or not needs to be determined by textual intersection. So I definitely think there are categories of differences of imperial interaction. I think Pax et Securitas in 1 Thessalonians 5 is a much different context than grace and peace to you. Much different. Because whenever he says they will be crying out peace and security, but suddenly destruction will befall them, hello. That's fighting words, because that's what Rome is crying out. Nevertheless, whenever he says, because of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I say to you, grace and peace. Now, are there tangential relations to the imperial language? Yes. Is that the primary purpose of what he's saying? It doesn't seem to be. It seems to be what he's doing is, because of what Jesus is, we are a completely different empire, therefore this language makes sense. So I think that for me, my problem with Empire Studies is the intent. They're always looking for a connection just to cut the legs out of the empire. And I think that pursuit can confuse us to what the goal of the actual Christians are. That's my whole argument with the book of Revelation. Does Revelation include anti-imperial elements? Yes, it does. However, is the goal of Revelation just to talk about the destruction of Rome? No. The goal of Revelation is to encourage chapters 2 and 3, Christians, in the seven churches of Asia Minor, to stand firm in the face of persecution, both physically and social seduction, whenever they have so much money that they don't need God for anything. Therefore, the goal of Revelation is bigger than the empire, even though it includes it. And that's, to me, my number one critique of Empire Studies is, you can't reduce the documents down. To say that the documents are only about the destruction of Rome is to reduce their purpose down to something that's merely peripheral and yet still there. Does that make sense? Nevertheless, to say they don't engage the empire at all is to simply overlook what we know about imperial language, about the imperial context. To suggest that we can write anything, even today, in a vacuum that doesn't interact with our society is simply foolish. Even though my goal is to build up the church, inevitably, there's going to be things that I say that people will not be okay with me saying because of the context we live in. For me to call our church, notice even what I said there, a nation. God's nation is the church. It's not America, it's the church. Some people won't even like the fact that I just said that. But I get that from 1 Peter. That's what he says very clearly. He's saying, no, we are God's kingdom. We are a holy nation. You pledge allegiance to us. As a matter of fact, in Philippians 1, whenever he says, conduct yourself in a worthy manner, the word he used there is politics. We are a polis, a separate city, a separate nation. You just happen to be living in this geographical location of which some people are claiming to be their own. And what am I doing? I'm just saying theology. Nevertheless, whenever I'm saying the theology, inevitably, people overhearing it will not be okay with it because they're claiming the same territory I'm claiming. But I'm claiming it for Jesus. And I look at him and say, you can have the land. We don't need the land. Well, if you don't obey this, we're going to kick you out of the land. That's your choice. And if you do, I will submit to you and obey you. Nevertheless, it's not going to change the way I think of the kingdom of God. The kingdom of God is bigger than any geographical location, any government, at any time. And any entity or institution that tries to claim otherwise is going against what Jesus has laid down. That language right there will get me booted out of churches. But is my goal to be anti-American? No, not at all. I'm very thankful. Nevertheless, my commitments are against their propaganda. And that's the problem. Whenever I say, sorry, I will never be primarily an American citizen over a citizen of the kingdom of heaven. Ever. It's not even a close second. I am such a citizen of the kingdom of heaven that I don't even really consider myself a citizen of anywhere but heaven. I don't know how you... Dual citizenship doesn't make sense in the kingdom of God. You have one master, one king, one kingdom. Period. I'm building up the kingdom. By default, I'm putting myself in conflict with the kingdoms of the world. You see the problem? Therefore, I do not believe that the goal of the documents that we have in our Bible is to destroy Rome. I don't think that's their goal. Nevertheless, the message they're speaking will put them in conflict with Rome because they're claiming the same territory at the same time. Yeah. Yeah.
What is the issue of being, like, he said, I think it was like page 5, talked about how Mark was probably 70, Matthew, maybe John, 80s, 90s. That's a little later than most traditions. Especially, I was a little confused with, like, Matthew traveling with Jesus. You talked about how lifespans were pretty short. How is somebody writing, 70 years after they're already maybe at the earliest 20 or so in the Gospels? I mean, that would require him to be almost 80, 90 years old as a peasant who, he already said, hardly lived past, whatever. And I think it kind of comes into, section. I haven't researched it enough.
No, let me say a couple of things about that. First of all, with Matthew, he wouldn't be considered a peasant. He was a tax collector and lived a pretty cushy life until he followed Jesus.
John,
we know, was a lucrative businessman because even fishermen, even though they may have been uneducated, were quite lucrative when it came to business. That's one of the reasons why Judea in the south was very jealous of Galilee in the north. Matter of fact, we even know that John had hired men. If you have hired men, it means your business is doing well. You're not a peasant that you have peasants, servants. The hired men would be the ones that would probably be considered doing most of the labor, even though John himself would have been doing stuff. We know John writing in the 90s. He was a young man, and we don't know the age of Matthew whenever he followed Jesus. Now, he may be suggesting that Matthew is not the actual author of Matthew. That's possible with his dating. Nevertheless, I'm not going to insert that into his mouth because even though the life expectancy was lower at their time period, it doesn't mean that there weren't people that lived beyond the life expectancy.
I'm not saying that is the case, because like I just said I researched all, but my question is, is that later than traditional dating?
Oh, yeah.
Necessary for empire studies? For example, in the talking about the half shekel from the fish's mouth to pay the tax, brings into the statement there, mm-hmm. which is 70.
Yep.
Would that, I don't know, because I kind of see, if Jesus is talking about that, he's obviously not talking about the spacious. Matthew might be, but it's like, well then, we're kind of getting away from what Jesus actually meant with that if we're applying it to a 70-80 situation.
Are we?
If Jesus said it in 30-something, he's obviously not talking about 70s.
Right, he's not talking about Vespasian the person, but he could still be talking about the institution that is symbolized by the giving of the tax.
But he said really what made that such a fiery thing was that Vespasian used that tax to become a punitive thing on the Jews. I'm just trying to...
And here's the question. Here's the question that actually plays into interpretation huge. What's the goal of the Gospels? Is it always Now, you're going to hear the opposite of what I'm saying. The opposite of what I'm saying is not true. Is it always to record historically accurate, absolutely every moment, the exact movements of Jesus, and that's their only goal? Is that the goal, especially even defined by the way in which we mean history? Is that their goal? Or is their goal to use what Jesus did to make theological points to develop their alternative empire in the time in which they're living? And we would say, well, you can't do that. Well, okay, let's just act like they did. Okay? Can we still say they can't do that? You see my point? In other words, the goal of Matthew may be different than what we want the goal of Matthew to be. So we can change it. I'll be honest with you, I think that the implications of Matthew being... I don't think Matthew has to be late. Nevertheless, the dating of Mark, if you do take Mark in priority, it's going to push Matthew back. I actually tend to think that Mark and Matthew were probably almost simultaneously published. Although if somebody put me in a corner and said which one came first, I would say Mark. But we know Mark was published in 67 to 70. Well, I'm sorry, I think Mark was, because of the anti-Marcionite prologue, which said it was published in memoriam of Peter after his death. Therefore, if Mark is in 67 to 70, Matthew has to at least be in the late 60s and early 70s. So to push it back an extra 10 years, maybe for reasons of more textual critical reasons, nevertheless, it's still in the Flavian dynasty. And the fact of the matter is whether or not that shekel was around whenever Jesus was there or not, the point of what Jesus is talking about in that moment is not differed. It just maybe it's kind of like us, you know, we do this all the time in sermons, don't we? All the time. Well, we will anachronistically put stuff into the story of Jesus to bring it more home, and yet it doesn't change the point of what we're saying. Does it?
Well, I know they're not modern writers like we are. I mean, it has to be ordered and perfect in a court.
Sure, yeah.
I understand that. So I just want to see if that later dating was necessary. I guess I didn't research it.
Yeah, necessary, maybe not. Maybe not necessary. Nevertheless, unjustified, then I would say, well, it may not be unjustified, even if it's not necessary. Because there are some interesting connections with Matthew and Vespasian that you can't just bat an eye at. And we've talked about in Tacitus. I read this in Mark class, the Tacitus section, where Vespasian has a couple miracles all in a row that he does. And in Matthew's gospel, this is more striking than Mark's gospel. Matthew's gospel is the exact same order that Jesus does those. Could that be forcing something? Maybe. Or, if this was widely known about Vespasian, and it's put in there, it could be saying something in dialogue with the empire. Any other thoughts, reflections? Yes, Si?
You probably had this question a lot. But
maybe not.
is there a resource or number of resources that, like the IVP dictionaries, where they have the background text, do they look at empire studies throughout the whole New Testament?
No. Warren Carter, I mean, like, I've given you guys authors that are developing this. A lot of the stuff you're doing, you're doing cutting-edge stuff. Like, your observations in your own text, you may be able to find from some people that have written on it, but there's some books that just haven't had this consistently wove through. Like Philippians, no one's consistently done empire studies through Philippians or Galatians. Or really, well, I mean, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians will overlap some because of the imagery. Nevertheless, primarily where empire studies is at right now is in the Gospels specifically, and then generally in Paul. My goal is to take it to Revelation in a responsible way, and I'm expecting you guys to be able to advance it in your particular books. But no, that's what I mean. This is emerging. This is not emerged. This is an emerging study in New Testament scholarship, which is one of the reasons why it's so important for you guys to see the pitfalls right now so that you can critique it over the next 10 years. Eventually there will be. And maybe you'll be a part of writing that. And that's good. Okay? All right, good discussion. We'll dive right back into the Principate on Thursday. Love you. See you then.